What do you think President Putin is thinking right now, just a few days after the worst terror attack in his country in the last 20 years? Only a week out from a rigged election where you promised to protect the people of Russia. Talk about going from a great week to a bad week. Welcome, friends, to the Headlines and History Podcast, Episode 5, in the early stages of our journey here. Thanks to everyone who's joining us for the first time, and another thanks to those that have come back. Hopefully, the first few episodes have been informative, somewhat entertaining, possibly. Okay, this week, given what's been happening in the news, particularly in Russia, I think it's, you know, without a question, we have to discuss this ISIS attack in Moscow. It's a huge story in the foreign affairs world, and it really has pretty significant consequences for, you know, the political environment in Moscow, for President Putin himself, potentially even the war in Ukraine. And just its gruesome nature in and of itself is enough of a story to have a conversation about. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the context and the history around what happened this week and what it might mean for, again, Russia itself, or even the greater region, potentially even the world, if it affects directly the war in Ukraine. So, as I stated in the beginning, Russia experienced its first major terror attack in 20 years this past week. It was on Friday, March 22nd, when four Tajikistan-based ISIS Khorasan gunmen, they entered the Crocus Music Center in Moscow, which is about 20 kilometers from the Kremlin, and began an attack just before the music group Picnic kicked off a concert. They began shooting event goers at will, first in the entrance area, and then they moved down inside to the seating area. And they had with them AK-47s as well as some Molotov cocktails, which they used to ignite the building. They did that rather successfully. If you happen to see the video from that night, there's plenty of footage from individuals who were driving on the highway past, and you could see that there's plenty of fire. I've seen some footage, not only from outside, but some from inside, that's pretty gruesome. I mean, at one point, there are probably 15 people huddled into a corner, nowhere to go, and one gunman, let's just say, focuses his attention on them in particular. It's pretty awful. On top of that, ISIS themselves released body camera footage, and it is awful stuff. I really don't suggest you watch it, honestly. All told, the attacks took approximately 20 minutes. As of this recording today, on the 26th of March, just 4 days after, we know of about 130 people have died. I think the exact total is 137 as of today. Scores more were injured. And this was out of approximately 6,000 ticket holders, they thought. I'm sure we're going to hear of additional dead in the coming days as dozens remain in serious condition, too. So, rather interestingly, though, to me at least, is the fact that all four shooters were able to escape, at least temporarily, before eventually being captured a few hours later. I say this because suicide operations are a common tactic with ISIS, but clearly that wasn't used here. Now, that could have been for many reasons. Maybe they can't recruit enough individuals who are looking to die when they conduct attacks, at least voluntarily. Who knows? But something I found slightly interesting, nonetheless. Given the mission that they were on, it looks as if killing as many people as possible, suicide vests can cause some major damage. Who knows? But now, in terms of how long the attack was, estimates are right now that pretty much it only took about 20 minutes before they were ever to flee. Let me address here quickly the security response time, as that topic has become a point of contention throughout the internet and the social media worlds. 20 minutes is not a long time for law enforcement or military personnel, in this case the National Guard, to respond and address the situation. First, even the most advanced and capable special operations teams or SWAT teams here in the U.S. do not sit around fully geared up with loaded weapons and vehicles running. It just doesn't work that way. Once information is received about a catastrophic event, it takes a few minutes to gather personnel, get to the scene, even if the location is just down the road a few miles. Second, the situation has to be assessed before action can be taken. Response teams don't just go running into a gunfight without any intelligence because they can end up causing more harm than good. All right. Then you add in the calls to 112, which is Russia's 9/11, and how long it takes to receive, kind of coordinate and address those. Adding all these things together, you're looking at precious time adding up before an effective response can be really mounted. I'm not surprised that the shooters were able to conduct their plan and flee before security forces responded, all within 20 minutes. This could happen anywhere in the world, and it's certainly not the fault of Moscow's law enforcement. So, and I've read plenty online and some analysts saying that, you know, this wouldn't have been as bad if the security services were able to get there in time. Listen, 20 minutes is just not a long time. I don't care who you are. According to Russian officials, the shooters fled west towards Ukraine, which Putin said was intentional because Ukrainian officials were somehow supporting the escape. Now, I find that to be highly unlikely, given the fact that the border is currently closed due to a conventional war. Additionally, the Belarusian border is in a similar direction, and since the fighters were eventually identified as Tajiks, as I had said earlier, the Belarus angle to me is a little bit more likely. I don't really think they were headed towards Ukraine. I mean, it's possible, but even if they were, they would have struggled to get across the border, again, because there's a war going on there. And I really don't think that the Ukrainians were somehow in cahoots and were allowing these individuals to escape. I guess it's possible. I just haven't seen that evidence, and I just find it less likely. Anyway, initial reports say that 11 people were arrested, and a total of 4, the ones I mentioned earlier, were directly involved. Russian MP Alexander Kinstein said the attackers fled in a white sedan and were able to make it approximately, I think he said somewhere in the area of 340 kilometers before being stopped. Putin reported it this way.
All 4 direct perpetrators of the terrorist attack, all those who shot and killed people, were found and detained. They tried to hide and move towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary data, a window was prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border. A total of 11 people were detained.
Now, how were the shooters able to enter Russia? All 4 were found with visas from Tajikistan, and 2 of which were expired. And this is a common tactic, getting visas for education or work or other things, overstaying your visa. It happens to all countries in the world, to include the United States. You finally blend in with the populace, and then you're really difficult to find. That's how these individuals were able to get inside Russia, specifically Moscow. Now, as of now, I don't have any insight into what happened to those that were arrested but not directly involved, so the 7 out of the 11. However, the 4 we know who did the shooting are in Russian custody, and let's just say they don't look their best, okay? Of course, I can't say for certain, right, but it would be fair to say that each shooter was subjected to some heavy-handed interrogations. One almost lost his right ear, just as a matter of fact. He had a towel over it, likely because they were looking to draw out some timely intelligence, should there been any, right? According to Moscow City Court, all 4 are in pretrial custody until their next court date, which is May 22nd, I believe. Interestingly, at these pretrial hearings, 3 have already pled guilty. I don't know. I haven't been able to find what happened to the 4th as of yet, but 3 did plead guilty. Now, I'm not an expert, particularly in the Russian judicial system, so I can't provide any analysis on what happens next or how the whole process will unfold. What I do know is that basically they're going to end up facing a trial. You know, the Russian government will present evidence, and we'll see what happens from there. Most likely, I can see them getting the death penalty if found guilty. But again, we'll watch to see what happens. Now, as for more details on how the event went down, I'm sure we'll see more that are forthcoming. You can look up, the reporting of many news outlets across the world describing exactly how this whole thing went down. But that's not really the point of this podcast here anyways, right? So we're here to talk about the so what in the historical context. So you've got the basics of what happened, how it went down, the four gunmen, multiple dead. So let's turn to the so what. Okay, so the first conversation I'd like to have regards the blame game and American involvement, which President Putin started at the outset. Immediately after the attack, reporting resurfaced of the American embassy in Moscow warning of a potential terror attack at a large gathering. The report stated that the U.S. was, quote, monitoring reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, end quote. The CENTCOM commander, General Michael Kurilla, testified on the Hill just this past March 7th, warning of potential ISIS-K terror attacks in addition. Listen here.
The risk of attack emanating from Afghanistan is increasing. I assess ISIS Khorasan retains the capability and will to attack U.S. and Western interests abroad in as little as 6 months and with little to no warning.
On top of that, a National Security Council spokesperson, Adrian Watson, said they had, quote, shared this information with Russian authorities in accordance with its longstanding duty to warn policy, end quote. So you might be thinking, aren't Washington and the Kremlin at odds right now? I mean, that's obvious and all over the news, right? So, and the answer is yes. However, when it comes to terrorism and innocent civilians, believe it or not, most countries still warn each other in an attempt to prevent innocent people dying. Russia does the same for us. It's a duty to warn that most countries follow. Just because both governments are not on the best of terms doesn't mean we can't find some common ground somewhere. Right? The U.S. and Russia even collaborate in space right now, as an example, on the International Space Station. If you think back, Putin was very much on the side of the U.S. after 9/11 as well. He worked very closely with President Bush. You may even recall President Bush's comments that he could see inside Putin's soul, which ended up being a pretty big blunder for him. But nonetheless, Putin and Bush did work pretty closely together after 9/11. Putin despises terrorism, well, terrorism that isn't his, as much as anybody else. Now, ironically, just because Putin takes the information to keep his people safe, that doesn't mean he still won't use it for political purposes as well. In this instance, before the attack last Friday, Putin complained that he received this warning that the U.S. had described they sent, but called it, quote, provocative, end quote, and said, quote, these actions resemble outright blackmail, end quote. Listen here.
I should also remind you of the recent, to put it bluntly, provocative statements by a number of official Western structures about the possibility of terrorist attacks in Russia. All this resembles blatant blackmail and an intention to sow fear and destabilize our society.
Now, he says this, hedging his bets, hoping an attack actually wouldn't occur, right? To shift the blame and make others seem like the bad guys. All politicians do it to some extent, and so this isn't really a surprise. But understand, he will take the warning just in case. So he'll accept the information. He won't tell anybody he accepted the information. If he can use it to keep his people safe, he will. But he's still going to come out and play the politician. This time, though, his problem right now is that he gambled an attack wouldn't occur, and now he has egg on his face by claiming the U.S. is simply playing games, which, now looking at 137 dead, clearly wasn't the case. Also, the use of the word blackmail is intriguing here because blackmail infers a return of some kind, and I don't know what the U.S. would get out of that sort of deal. I don't know what they would gain from it. Putin's description was that, you know, the United States was just kind of trying to muddy the waters in a way, and it would make Russia look unstable, and I don't think the U.S. gets anything out of that, right? Russia already looks unstable. Russia's already struggling in Ukraine. Certainly, the United States doesn't need to kill a whole host of innocent civilians to make that point. It just seems silly. Anyway, did Putin take the information to heart? We don't know, but I will say most likely yes. Right? It's likely the details weren't specific enough to stop the four gunmen, though. That's certainly possible. It's also possible, and again, I'm just speculating here, that the U.S. couldn't provide enough detail without disclosing sources and methods. I mean, we know that's a major challenge with intelligence. Sometimes the intelligence itself reveals where it came from, and most intelligence agencies aren't in the business of revealing how they do their job. Again, so pure speculation on my part, but maybe the intel was even perfect. Who knows? Maybe we'll never find out. But either way, you know, I do think it's likely that the U.S. did pass the information because of the duty to warn. What Putin did with it, if it wasn't good enough, I don't know. The takeaway here is how Putin plays it for his political advantage. Another aspect of this American involvement, if you will, is the social media chatter that America, particularly the CIA, was somehow involved. Now, I won't spend much time here because the notion is pretty wild, but however, I'm sure some people actually think that to be true, so we can spend 10 seconds on it. Whether the U.S. or the CIA is capable of some action like that isn't the point. It's about what the U.S. would gain vice what they would lose by conducting such an attack. I can assure you the U.S. and the CIA have more important things and more effective actions to take against Russia rather than paying some ISIS members to kill a bunch of civilians. Because clearly, ISIS claiming the attack as they're the ones responsible, there's nothing to be gained here. We don't need to prove that Putin is weak because, frankly, he's done enough of that damage himself since he failed in his invasion of Ukraine to reach Kyiv. Well, at least he failed in his end state, so no more wasted time on that. Switching to another potential perpetrator I've heard bandied about, including from Putin, which you did hear earlier in his speech, is Ukraine. The same logic applies here as it did with the U.S. Simply because Ukraine may be capable of such an action, it seems to me, doesn't mean they would. There's nothing really to be gained. First, any insider activity Ukraine has been involved in has been in the oblasts that border Ukraine between Russia. Okay, they have not taken any action, you know, any obvious action, let's just say, in Moscow. There's little to no military value in doing so. And right now, it looks as if all the decisions that Zelensky makes at least have military benefits to them. Now, don't take this to mean that Ukrainian intelligence doesn't work on strategic targets within Russia. Of course they do. All sophisticated militaries do. What I mean is they wouldn't waste precious resources on an act so gruesome without gaining a major advantage as a result, like I said. Second, Ukraine is pretty busy trying to survive on the battlefield. Any special forces available for use are working diligently to fight their main enemy in their territory. Moscow isn't really on their minds right now, at least tactically. Third, it's obvious now, whether you have some conspiratorial thoughts about outsiders influencing a terror group, ISIS fighters did the attack. Okay, if you believe Ukraine, for the U.S. in this case, somehow convinced terrorists that hate them to help them attack Russia, I don't think it seems pretty feasible, okay? Oh, and fourth, and maybe not worth mentioning, but I'll do it anyways, ISIS claimed responsibility and provided video and photographic proof. So I think we stand at a place right now where it's pretty clear this is an ISIS event. Based on what I just said, let me say parenthetically, because I think this is important. Give me a second, indulge me. This type of thinking, that it was the U.S. or Ukraine or Mossad or CIA, whatever, spits in the face of one of my favorite logical philosophies, and that's Occam's razor. This is the idea of William of Ockham, a 14th century friar, who said that unexplained phenomena are often best explained by the simplest of any competing theories. Simply put, the most basic answer is likely the right one. This is something so many people ignore today in the age of the internet. It's as if the simple answer isn't fun or controversial enough to gain interest, so people gravitate to the more salacious, convoluted, scandalous, downright wacky explanations. Listen, in this case, what we know is ISIS hates Russia, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. It often kills civilians in terror attacks, and they took responsibility. That might not be the sexiest answer, but it sure seems like the right one, okay? Sometimes simple is better. Okay, back from my tangent, let's talk about the group itself, ISIS, and why they likely conducted the attack. First, a brief overview for those that don't spend all day thinking about ISIS and where they came from, okay? The Islamic State, sometimes called the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, as it was referred to for some years, or the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, which is what is more commonly used today, depending on who is the focus and what time period we are discussing, began in Iraq around the U.S. invasion of 2003 with an individual by the name of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, or Jordanian thug who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp, who, by the way, might have been as insane as Saddam Hussein's sons, interestingly enough, Uday and Qusay. And when I say insane, I mean a total lack of empathy and like immune to violence. He was practically nuts. Anyways, although the group started theoretically with Zarqawi, I want to make clear that it wasn't the name, the Islamic State wasn't in existence with that name at that time. That was later. At the time now, this is at the Zarqawi time, it was just his group, which he liked to call Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So anyways, long story short, Zarqawi, after a few terror attacks outside Iraq prior to the American invasion in 2003, made his way to Iraq to kill Americans. Wonderful. While there, he contacted Osama bin Laden looking for a official sanction, thereby going with the title of the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. With this title, Zarqawi would gain the wasta, the notoriety he was looking for. It's hard to become a popular and therefore well-resourced terrorist without a recognizable name. Okay, by asking bin Laden for his group's name, he could get some legitimacy. I mean, technically he swore baya, which means he swore loyalty to bin Laden. So, Zarqawi, Jordanian thug, operating as a terrorist throughout the Middle East, doesn't have a big name, comes to Iraq after the American invasion in 2003, really starts to conduct some pretty heavy attacks in 2004 and into 2005. 2005, I can speak from direct experience with this because I happened to be in Iraq in 2005 and in the same territory that Zarqawi was operating. It was a scary time with this guy running around the battle space, that's for sure. Eventually, he wants a little bit more credibility, so he asks bin Laden if he can use the name of Al-Qaeda. By doing so, this means that Zarqawi had to abide by bin Laden's rules and dictates, but in return, he would receive weapons and money. The problem is, after showing his true colors, by in addition to killing Americans, he killed thousands and thousands of Shias, who Zarqawi considered apostates, bin Laden removed his official sanction, leaving Zarqawi to endure without Al-Qaeda's blessing. Now, we all know how evil bin Laden was, but bear in mind, he did have a plan. His plan was to remove Americans and any other Christian crusaders, if you will, from the Holy Lands of the Middle East, and then push to establish a worldwide caliphate later. Bin Laden may not have agreed with Shiism, but it wasn't important to him to kill them outright. They didn't support his plan, and at the end of the day, they still were Muslims. Again, Zarqawi didn't agree that they were even Muslims, but bin Laden often did. The Shias weren't the target. Getting the foreigners out of Iraq was the point at the time. Zarqawi didn't agree. Finally, in 2006, after running around conducting as many attacks as he could, the most influential was the targeting of a Shia mosque in Samarra in 2006. But anyways, Zarqawi's killed by the Americans. Now we shift to the link with ISIS. 2 years before 2006, a guy by the name of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was detained in Buka Prison, which was a detention facility in Iraq, where he became further radicalized, more so than when he went in. He was quiet. He was a doctor, actually, had a PhD. He was quiet. He had a PhD. He was actually very well-read. He was intelligent, but he was pretty radical. And then when he went in and came out of Buka, he was even more radicalized. Once released, he began to gravitate towards Zarqawi's vision of creating a caliphate, which, again, was Al-Qaeda's long-term plan, but not the short-term plan like Zarqawi had, and basically, like, carried his mantle. He really said that he wanted to finish what Zarqawi started. This is why, although the Islamic State as a title didn't start until Baghdadi came on the scene, analysts proclaim that Zarqawi is really the theoretical originator of the Islamic State. He was the one that said... He, being Zarqawi, is the one that said, we have to develop a worldwide caliphate now, and we have to kill Shias in order to accomplish it. We have to kill Americans. We have to kill anybody we can. And when Baghdadi gets out of prison, he says, you know what? That's a philosophy I can work with and move forward with that. Baghdadi gathers a group of people who support his, and like I said previously, Zarqawi's vision, moves into a power vacuum in Syria during the civil war next door to Iraq, and starts forcing Sharia on whomever he can. The story goes on from there. There's much more, but that's the original. That's the beginning. Now, since this is not the history of ISIS episode, let's just skip to today in terms of what they're doing now. Right now, we have multiple what are called Islamic State provinces. They're governed by certain Islamic State leaders. Now, the one in question here, ISIS-K, is made up of Iran, Eastern Afghanistan, Central Asia, and Pakistan. We say ISIS-K or ISIS Khorasan, the name of the province that they created. The current leader of ISIS-K, Sanaullah Gafai, a 29-year-old specially designated global terrorist by the U.S., who was once thought dead, interestingly, and who was responsible for many, many, many attacks throughout Afghanistan, was believed to have approved the attack on Moscow. If history is any guide, knowing what kind of control he has within ISIS-K, it likely came from him. Now, given all the thoughts about the U.S. and Ukraine, why would ISIS attack a public gathering in Moscow? Well, it isn't as far-fetched as some may have you believe. Okay, first, probably most importantly, at least now, ISIS is enraged at President Putin for supporting the Shia leader of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, in the Syrian civil war. Now, Syria is mainly a Sunni state, and multiple Sunni terror groups are battling Assad for control over Syria, and they have been for years. The Sunni-Shia divide is not the only reason, but it plays a part given ISIS's extreme religious viewpoints. Putin has supported Assad since the start of the civil war because of weapons deals and, importantly, access to Syria's main warm water port in Tartus, which gives Russia access to the sea year-round. This is why the relationship with Assad is key. Also, if you remember, unless it's his own, Putin still isn't too supportive and doesn't appreciate terrorism in his own country. Second, Russia is an Orthodox Christian nation, mainly. So ISIS's views of establishing a worldwide caliphate run contrary to this, quote, Christian nation in Russia. That makes Moscow a viable target, just as much as it does the United States or any other, quote, unquote, Christian countries. Russia is one as well. So there's a viable reason to target Moscow. Third, and most basically, Russia is no supporter of terrorism, like I said. Well, Alexei Navalny. And therefore, just like any other country fighting against terrorism, Russians targetable. More specific and local, though, to Russia is that it is engaged in multiple battles with Chechen rebels, with whom ISIS shares certain ideologies. Not the same group, but they certainly think similarly. So in this instance, it's the enemy of my friend is also my enemy. Okay. Lastly, ISIS is really in a recruiting lull. This isn't news to anybody in the national security game, as multiple intelligence agencies have been reporting on this fact for a while now. So where else would you plan an attack if you were looking to garner attention in, you know, financial donations, weapons, money? How about the capital of a country currently embroiled in a hot war, which everyone in the world is watching? Seems pretty logical to me. So of all the possibilities, aside from the obvious of them taking credit and proving their involvement with video and photos, ISIS makes the most philosophical sense. So with all that, what does Putin do now? This is the question most analysts are chewing on. This must have hit Putin right in the gut. This is days after an election, the West claims is stolen, where Putin tried to sell, or did in fact sell, the notion of safety and security to the Russian people. Having a terror group launch the largest attack in two decades doesn't help with his marketing, that's for sure. So, as he's already done, he'll work diligently to shift the blame. He will claim it was Ukraine behind the attack and stick with that story. Bear in mind, too, this event is just a couple weeks after Dmitry Peskov admitted that Russia was no longer conducting, quote, a special operation in Ukraine, but is now fully at war. We've all known this in the West. Russia's finally admitting it. When putting these two developments together, Putin will blame Ukraine, and outside, we'll know better, but many Russians will accept this drivel, just as Putin intends. He's also going to increase security measures throughout major population centers. That's likely to do very little, given that terror attacks aren't typically followed by other terror attacks immediately afterwards, especially when the perpetrators of the first attack were captured. Nonetheless, he has to make that move in order to demonstrate strength, which is a political move for him. He's got to do it. Anybody would do it, he's going to do it. He assuredly won't do anything to the U.S., as he knows deep inside we attempted to help. So that he won't do. Will he take anything out on Ukraine? That's a good question. Potentially, but I don't know really how. He's already maxed out regarding units on the front line, and I just don't see a new operation or some type of a, you know, ground assault as a response. He just doesn't have the ability to do that right now. Right? He could go bold and target some key infrastructure in Kyiv or something, but that may just look like a petty response to most people and isn't really going to provide him much tangible benefit. I mean, I guess he wants to prove to his constituents that Ukraine was involved and he could pull the trigger, if you will, make a big splash. But I think most clear-headed non-Russians have certainly decided that ISIS was responsible for this thing. One thing to remember when having this discussion about Putin, he's not irrational, right? So whatever he does do will benefit him in some way. He's not going to randomly make some decision that doesn't help him or anyone else. He's not going to do something simply out of anger. It may not seem logical to us in the West. It may not seem like the smartest thing for him to do as we look through our lens. But in his world, he's not irrational. Whatever he's going to do is going to benefit him. At the end of the day, this is a pretty big gut punch for Putin. As I said earlier, he's coming off an election in which he was trying to prove he's the most capable leader of Russia, particularly from a security standpoint. And just a couple of days later, comes out in the world media that the United States warned him of a terror attack, likely in Moscow, likely at a large gathering. He blames the West for contriving nonsense. And then 140-ish civilians are dead. Doesn't look good. He can push as much blame onto Ukraine as he wants. And there, again, some Russians are going to eat it up. But most of the world knows differently. It remains to be seen, like I said, what he's going to do as a response. But potentially he could do nothing. He can increase security, try to blame it on Ukraine, sweep it under the rug and move on. Sweeping under the rug is going to be a challenge. First largest terrorist attack in 20 years. But when I say do nothing, I mean in terms of any monster response. But what I do know is he took a political hit. And one thing that we need to remind ourselves of, even though we were watching the election, quote-unquote election, last week, is that Putin's control is limited. It's limited in the sense that it doesn't compare to the countries like China or Kim Jong-un in North Korea, Assad in Syria. He still is beholden to some citizens. Particularly, he's definitely beholden to the oligarchs. So there are plenty of people in Moscow, plenty of people in Russia who support Putin. This is definitely true. But there are people that know the truth. There are people that when they say they approve of Putin, really they're just accepting of Putin. And so it's not unreasonable to think that enough of these acts, terror attacks, enough dead bodies coming back that are actual Russian citizens from the front line, that the populace is really going to get upset and they can get to a point where maybe he's really just not as popular as he thinks he is and he can't get as much done. Who knows? I mean, it's not, again, it's a system that we're not familiar with. Again, he is susceptible to public backlash in a way that he certainly doesn't find comfortable. So we'll see what comes out of this. We'll see if he takes any drastic action and, and if need be, we'll do another episode. We'll talk about this again should Putin decide to make any serious or catastrophic decisions. All right, that's it for this week. I appreciate you spending some time with me and having this discussion. As always, you can reach out to me at johnmollick@headlinesinhistory.com. You can find me on social, YouTube. Find me at my website, headlinesinhistory.com, Facebook, Instagram. And feel free to reach out if you have any questions. And I look forward to talking to everybody next episode.